This is Lars. Thanks again for checking out my podcast. Enjoy your day and the show, and let's make America great again.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show, and welcome to the Radio Northwest Network. We serve the three-state region of Oregon, Washington, and Idaho. And let me bring an issue to your attention that ought to be of concern to everyone, because it is government trying to dip into your pockets once again. Now, they do this all the time, but in the Seattle area, they already know about tolling on freeways because it's being done there. And they're dipping millions of dollars out of the pockets of commuters. And now the city of Portland has announced that the Oregon Transportation Commission will ask the federal government's permission to start putting tolls on Interstate 5 or Interstate 205 or both of those freeways by the end of the year. And I saw a lot of public opposition to this. I've heard from a lot of you who've called me and said, how do we stop this? And I said, go to the public hearings and show your opposition. And they did. And now the government has done what it so frequently does, is said, yeah, we heard all your opposition, and we're going to go ahead and do it anyway. We don't care what you had to say about it. And I thought, well, if there's one person in the entire state who would come out and take a strong stance against this, it would have to be the Republican nominee for governor of the state of Oregon, and that's Newt Bueller, who joins me right now. So, Newt, it's good to have you back on the program. I take it the campaign is going well, but I want to know where you come down on this issue of the state of Oregon asking the federal government for permission to tax people through tolling for driving on freeways that the taxpayers of Oregon and Washington have already paid for. Are you for it or against it?
I'm completely against it, Lars, and it's why I voted against the transportation package when it came through the legislature. I knew they didn't have a plan to relieve Portland's congestion without tolling existing roads. And, you know, the plan is short on new lanes to relieve congestion, as long on taxes, tolls, and will really do nothing or little to relieve the congestion's problems in the Portland metro area.
You and I both know that the transportation rocket scientists are already planning to spend a couple of billion dollars on one light rail line that only goes 12 miles. And I guess my question would be, if you've got a couple of billion to spend on light rail, why is it you need to toll people to drive on the roads they've already paid for to be able to scare up a much smaller number than that to be able to make necessary improvements to the freeways? Because that's the argument they're using, isn't it? We have to have the money, otherwise we can't afford to fix the freeways. Well, if they've got a couple of billion dollars to build a light rail line that's going to serve a few thousand people a day, do they have, say, half a billion or a billion to fix the freeways on which hundreds of thousands of people drive every day?
Look, Lars, Governor Brown has not met a tax she won't support or sign into law. And if people are really concerned about, and they should be concerned about tolling existing roads that you're using every day for free. The only way to stop that, I'm convinced, is to have a Republican governor, have me as governor, that will veto that as it comes through the legislature. You can see this has been preloaded from the very beginning. You talked about the public hearings, the ruling of the Oregon Transportation Commission. It was pre-baked in the legislation. That's why I voted against it. The way to stop this incessant increase in taxes in Oregon is to elect Bueller as governor.
Well, and let me ask you this. I know that you're running for the job to represent the state of Oregon as the governor of Oregon, but I'd like you to speak to another issue that I also have not heard Kate Brown speak about. You and I both know, and I have a dog in the fight. I drive across that river every day because I'm a Clark County, Washington resident, so I have a bias, but I'm not advocating for this or against this because of that bias. I'm asking, is it reasonable to impose a toll that will, for the most part, fall on Washington state residents and then say, we're going to take your money and we're going to spend it south of the Oregon, south of the Oregon-Washington line? That also seems highly, well, unfair is too mild a term for it. But you're going to soak people from another state for all this money, and then say, but you have no say in how it's spent, and you have no say in what we're going to do with it.
Well, look, this is unfair in a lot of ways. You know, Congressman Jamie Herrera, Bueller has been a leading advocate making that argument. They shouldn't be tolling Washingtonians to pay mostly for Oregon infrastructure. And look, it's unfair to hardworking Oregonians in East County who are just trying to get to work and do their jobs without increasing capacity. It just says another example of the long mismanagement of the state of Oregon by Governor Brown, and that's why we need new leadership. And I'll clearly lead on this issue like so many others where Governor Brown has failed.
I'm talking to Newt Bueller, who's the Republican nominee for governor of Oregon. We've extended the same invitation to the Democrat nominee, and that's Kate Brown. She has not so far even returned our phone calls, nor has her campaign. But let me ask you this. It sounds as though the Transportation Commission, having already written a budget for these things, and predicated it on the arrival of these tolling dollars, they seem to think they can get the federal transportation authorities to sign off, because that's a requirement, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a requirement to get the federal sign-off. I don't know where that process is, but they're going full speed ahead to introduce new tolls. And keep in mind, Lars, you know, this is not the only new tax that came through this transportation package. You know, there's a new tax on cars.
New cars, yeah.
Yeah, which, you know where that goes? That's, I call it the Tesla tax, right? Because all those dollars don't go to provide more lane capacity. It goes to actually supplement people who want to buy electric vehicles. You know, there's a new tax on even bicycles. I mean, there is not a tax that Governor Brown has not found that she supports. It just becomes ridiculous, especially at a time of record revenue. Enough is enough.
Hey, Newt, before I let you mention the website for your campaign, I want you to speak to a slightly bigger issue that has to do with this, though. You mentioned this was already baked in the cake, and they go out and they hold public hearings, and they beg people to come out and spend hours and hours of their evenings off to come to a public hearing, to wait in line for hours, to step up to the mic and say maybe 2 or 3 minutes of testimony. All of those people did all of that. Isn't this effectively lying to the public when you say we're going to hold a lot of public hearings, we want all this public participation, knowing that they have no intention of following what is said at those public hearings, not one inch?
I see it a little differently, Lars. I see it as an arrogance of power. That the people in Salem, the Salem Democrats, Governor Brown, they're smarter than everyone else. They know the right way to do it. And despite all the hearings and all the people coming and expressing themselves so well, they're going to ignore that. They know better. They're not very good at listening, and they're certainly not very good at learning. Look at the Portland metro area and the congestion that all of us have to deal with every day. It's enormously frustrating, and they're just doubling down on their failed policies.
Well, and the fact that they won't even say today, they've already narrowed the number of choices from 8 down to 5. And I have a feeling that someone within that bureaucracy knows exactly which one they're going to go with, because if they know how much money they have to generate, and I imagine their engineers and their actuaries and all that have figured out which one will generate the cash that they have, they probably already know exactly the option that they're going to go with when they're at the end of this process. But they won't tell the public that, because I think they know the public's going to react adversely to that. Do you agree?
I suspect they already have a ranking up priority of where they're going to place the tolling based on the maximum amount of revenue that they're going to generate. And that's what a lot of these tax structures have really been about, is generating as much revenue as possible to cover for the policy objectives that they want to do, instead of bringing the cost of the state of Oregon under control, or actually doing something productive like adding more lane and bridge capacity to the Portland metro area.
Would you commit at this point as a candidate that you would not impose tolls on people where they're effectively forced to rent space on a freeway that they already own? Would you commit to that at this point as a candidate?
Absolutely. Unless it's to build a new bridge or a new lane or a new freeway. I think that's something we'd have to consider, but only new capacity. Absolutely not tolling existing roads like Governor Brown is proposing here.
Hey, if you would build a brand new bridge that I had to drive on every morning, and they built one that was sensible, that had more lanes instead of the same number of lanes, I got to tell you, Newt, I'd pay that toll, because I think that's reasonable. I'm willing to pay for what I use, but I'm not willing to pay an additional toll to drive on freeways that my taxes have already paid for. I think that's what's unreasonable. And I don't know, I wish I could have got you to say that it's lying, not just because it's radio, but here's the thing. If somebody comes to me and says, Lars, I'd like your opinion on this, I'm trying to make a decision. And they say, but by the way, I've already made the decision, but I'm going to pretend to listen to you because it's good politics to pretend to hear what you have to say. But I've already made the decision. To me, that's a lie.
Well, it's yeah, you certainly could call it that. I think it's just the arrogance of power, and it's one of the reasons I'm running for governor. I'm fed up. I've had a front row seat to it. I've had the arrogance of power coming from the leadership in Salem, specifically Governor Brown, where we've had severe mismanagement and incompetence in running our state government, and we need some solutions to the problems that everyday Oregonians are facing. And one of the biggest problems I hear about, Lars, traveling around the state, is we've driven up the cost of just simply living here, the high cost of housing, of health care, of child care, and now we're going to add the high cost of actually driving your car on existing freeways, and people's wages just haven't kept up with it, and because of it, people are struggling every month to balance their checkbook, and enough is enough.
Newt, what's the website where people can help out your campaign to replace Kate Brown?
You bet, Lars. It's NewtBuehler.com or Dr. Newt Buehler on Facebook.
Very good. Newt, thanks so much for the time.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Lars.
Take care now. And by the way, I extend the invitation to the other side every single day. If the Democrat or a Democrat or any Democrat wants to get on and tell me why tolling people to drive on a freeway they've already paid for, they're doing it in Seattle right now. They want to do it in Oregon. It is an outrageous decision, and I'm glad to take your calls. Naysayers, of course, go first here at 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk@LarsLarson.com.
That makes a lot of sense, a lot of nonsense.
Right, you're bloody well right, you know you got a right to say.
This is the Northwest Nonsense, presented by the Ryan Group, where they guarantee to sell your house in 29 days or less, or they'll buy it. 29andgone.com.
How much longer do we have to sit for this nonsense?
No left-leaning, dead fish rapper bias. No mega TV network liberal agenda. Just the cold hard facts from Lars.
Well, at least two big birthdays today. The United States Army celebrates its birthday today, and Donald Trump celebrates his 72nd birthday. He's getting the best present this president could ever hope for, a report from the Inspector General that reveals the conspiracy inside the FBI and the DOJ to stop Donald Trump from becoming president. Hillary Clinton turned the U.S. State Department into a cash machine, selling favors to big donors of the Clinton Crime Family Foundation. To make that happen, Clinton maintained an illegal computer system transmitting classified information to such notable figures as pervert former Congressman Anthony Weiner under his nom de sex, Carlos Danger. The actions of fired FBI Director James Comey got some hard scrutiny in that report. So does Deputy Andrew McCabe, also fired. McCabe's wife, it seems, got big bucks from top Democrats for her failed political campaign. Lots of payoffs in this situation. Two other top officials, Lisa Page and Peter Strzok, had been doing the nasty and sharing their hatred of Donald Trump in tweets. They even bragged, "We won't let Trump become president." Literally, that is straight out of the Inspector General's report. Starting to get the picture of what was going on there, and the DOJ fed info to the Clinton presidential campaign. It's a hot, hot mess, and the report hit the press just about 2 hours ago. Happy birthday, Mr. President.
Insane.
Are you completely insane?
Ridiculous.
They get more and more ridiculous.
Flat out dumb.
You're even dumber than I thought.
Who deserves today's Lars Grill of the Day?
Maybe they're just really, really stupid.
Find out right now. Brought to you by Dan Jones Conveyor Trucks. Rock, granite, topsoil, or sand. Let Dan Jones Conveyor Trucks put it where you want it.
Today's Daily Grill goes to the transportation planners who are currently, as we stand here, committing $2.86 billion to a brand new Max Light rail line that is only 12 miles long, meaning the costs work out to well over $200 million a mile. Can you believe it? Yeah, they get the Daily Grill. And spending $2.86 billion on light rail that serves a few thousand people per train, and doing that when you're saying you're so broke that you've got to toll the federal highways, is absolute insanity. Teresa writes in, "Lars, my hubby had a show on with Megyn Kelly this morning. Couldn't believe what I was watching. They were talking about the illegal children who were split from their parents after being caught sneaking into our country. It showed one of the facilities that some of the boys were living in. They tried to make it sound horrible, and how can Trump do this to them? After all, they were only trying to come to the U.S. to live a better life, and they shouldn't be punished like this. They didn't murder or anything. They just came here here illegally. The place they showed me was amazing. They had video games, big screen TVs, pool tables, telephones, 3 to 4 beds per room that were nice. The rooms were pretty big. And then it showed them eating lunch. The tray had tons of food on it. Looked better than what my kids get at school. They're living better than most kids, and I'm sure it's better than where they came from. I just wonder how much this is costing us to provide nice meals and other luxury items they get to enjoy. I'm so tired of them trying to make Trump out to be so bad, the bad guy, when all he's doing is trying to put the legal citizens first. Thanks, Teresa. Teresa, thanks a lot for that. Let me go to a former ODOT employee, Stephen, who wanted us to comment on the idea of tolling federal freeways to take tens of millions of dollars out of people's pockets. What do you say about that, Stephen?
Hey, Lars. Yeah, that's one of the reasons I quit there is, you know, we had to do the public comments as a it's a law that we have to do. And so we only did the comments three different times because the law requires it. And we already predetermined exactly what we were going to do, where we're going to put the tolls, and how much we're going to charge, and what system we're going to use. So it's all preset. It's just going through the motions of the legal requirements to make it happen.
And what, I guess I'd ask as a citizen who's actually gone to public hearings as a reporter and as a citizen, what's the point of having these hearings when they're not going to hear what we have to say, or at least they're not going to pay attention to what we have to say?
Sadly, it's only because of law. We are required to have those hearings.
And so they're going to put on a show of listening to the people when, in fact, they don't listen to the people at all.
That's absolutely right. That's why I had to quit.
Stephen, that was probably a very good decision on your part. Can you imagine a private company saying, we want to hear from our customers, and then you tell them. And if you realize that there's a majority of the customers who are telling a particular business, we'd prefer you do it this way. When the business says, we're not going to do it that way, and they ignore you, you are free to take your business elsewhere. What do you do when it's a state that you live in, a state you have roots in, a state you own a house in, a state where your kids are going to school? What do you do when that state says, we represent you, but we are not going to listen to anything you have to say? I hope this becomes a major campaign issue between Kate Brown and Newt Bueller, and I hope she gets asked about it in one of the debates, since it sounds like Kate Brown is not going to give us one of the debates. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. We're live on the Radio Northwest Network and glad to take your phone calls and your emails from all over the Pacific Northwest. 24 radio stations carry this program on a daily basis, and we're glad for that. And I'm glad for the suggestions as well. Let me go first to Jim in Bellingham, listening on KGMI. Hey, Jim, you heard the story that we have a government that holds public hearings and that it's all just show. They hold the public hearing and then they don't do anything with it, with the information that's offered up by the public, and they simply go on with whatever it was they were planning to do. What's your suggestion?
Well, I would like to get it in the minds of people that public transportation is cheaper if it's done right and is a better solution for the climate crisis, which you may not believe in, but I think it's very real. The problem, as I see it, is that you're talking about all this expense for light rail, and, you know, I mean, what I'm saying is that once you bought a car, the great expense of buying a car, the cost of purchase,
cost of operating,
and so people that have already bought a car because, as you know, in Los Angeles,
okay,
in the
hold
30s,
on, Jim, you had a suggestion. This sounds like more like a diatribe. Tell me what your suggestion is.
I'm offering a suggestion. We should try to get people out of cars and into electric light rail.
Jim, can I tell you the truth of that? First of all, if you want to get people out of cars into buses, that has been tried for the last 40 years in the Northwest and other parts of the country. Do you know that the number of people per, you know, the number of people per 100,000 who ride transit today is lower than it was 40 years ago after tens of billions of dollars? And that's across the board. That's Portland, Seattle, all the big cities that have tried transit. Sure, there's a certain percentage of people who ride transit, but the number of people per 100,000. So even with population growth built into that, you have fewer people riding transit today
per capita than you did 40 years ago, and that's after billions of dollars. Secondly, as far as electric light rail, you seem enamored with that. Do you know if you took 1 mile of light rail track in Seattle, 1 mile of their newest project is $500 million. That would buy 1,000 rubber-tired buses if you got rid of 1 mile of light rail. In other words, it's like buying a Ferrari. It's cute to look at, but it's very expensive, and it doesn't carry very many people. Would you rather, and I'll ask you this, since you're a fan of transit, would you rather give up 1 mile of light rail and buy 1,000 new buses at $500,000 apiece, or would you rather have that mile of light rail? Which one do you think will move more people?
Personally, I think it's both should be used. It should be.
You didn't answer. No, if you're not going to listen to the question and answer it, then I'm going to let you go.
I did listen to the question.
Well, which one carries more people?
They're good for.
Okay, Jim is just going to yammer, but I think most of you can work the math. Which one carries more? 1 mile of light rail track or 1,000 rubber-tired city buses? And yet they don't go that direction because, for some reason, the transportation authorities just love light rail, even though it's hideously expensive. Anyway, I'm going to bring on Mike Strickland. Mike, you might remember, or if you don't, was a man who liked to document the activities of some of the crazy lunatic groups that like to protest on the streets of Northwest cities. Antifa, Black Lives Matter, all these groups that like to set fires, break windows, throw highway flares into stores, set cop cars on fire, defecate on the roadway, things like that. And Mike would go down as a blogger and an investigative journalist, and he would take pictures. And then there was a moment where five different people were coming right at him with signs in their hands, and they were advancing on him, and he pulled a gun out of his holster for 4 seconds. He was convicted in that case. I don't think he should have. His actions were in self-defense. No shots were fired. No one got hurt. And yet Mike Strickland was convicted of a crime. Mike, we wanted to check in with you and see where your case sits at this point.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Yeah, and people can see the videos of what had actually happened up on my YouTube channel, Laughing at Liberals. In fact, I did a five-camera angle analysis of everything that really details it all. But anyways, the case is plodding through the appeals process. We made that clear, you know, from the day of the verdict that we were going to appeal the case. And so we filed the motion for the appeal.
Yeah.
And then it took us 4 months to get the transcripts, because procedurally you need to get all the transcripts from everything that was said throughout all the proceedings.
Right.
So it took them 4 months to produce those for us, which my appeals attorneys say they've never seen a case take that long to get the transcripts for. So we filed our initial brief within the time allotted to do that. And then the state was on the clock. We did that in December. Mm-hmm. So we got the transcripts in mid-October. We got our initial written brief in mid-December. I don't remember the exact dates off the top of my head.
Right.
So then the state's response was due, and they were on the clock then for 45 days. So come near the end of January, when their response is due, they motion for a 131-day extension of time to be able to put together their written brief. And before we even had a chance to, before I was even informed of this, the judge James Egan, the chief judge of the appeals court, whom I have voted for twice, I believe, had signed off on their extension, thereby making it due in June.
On June the 11th.
Yeah. Yeah. So this past Monday, the attorney for the state, this is one of Ellen Rosenblum's assistants, Susan G. Howe is her name.
Yeah.
So she then informs us that she is going to file a motion to bypass the rules of the appeals court, now a second time, because she can't get her written brief under the word limit of 10,000 words.
So there's, I don't think a lot of people might be aware of that, but I would imagine that for the appeals court, if you just said to a lawyer, write your appeal, a lot of lawyers might go 100,000 words because they figure more words make them more convincing. It's not true, but I'm sure the appeals court wants some limit on it so that you don't have an, you know, an appeal that goes on forever. She couldn't get it said in 10,000 words?
No, 10,000 words is the limit, and ours was under that, and ours was timely. She has now motioned twice to outright, you know, bypass the rules and exceed it by 2,000 words. Now, we formally opposed this, and she included that in her motion that we opposed it.
Yeah.
So she filed the motion along with her 12,000-word thing. And we were told by the court clerk that we had 14 days to file our official opposition to this.
Yeah.
Well, the very next day, we get it back that Judge Egan had already signed off on it.
So he's going to give her an edge. You're limited in the number of words your lawyer can file, but they're going to give the government extra words to make their case.
Not only that, but extra time, too. So she's had 7 months to do this. And, you know, I just view it as a disrespect to the courts. That either she's incompetent or she doesn't want to play by the rules. And, if I were a judge on the appeals court, I would take this as an insult.
Well, not only that, but the judge apparently granted, as you said, the motion the very next day. You were supposed to have 2 weeks to respond to her motion saying, I want more space. And the judge ruled on it the very next day on the 12th and said, okay, you can have the extra space. You can have the extra time. You know, I got to tell you, Michael, I've thought from the day they charged you with the ridiculous list of charges they brought to somebody who'd merely engaged in self-defense, I think the fix has been in. And I think the fix continues to be in. And I think Judge Egan may be part of it.
Well, hey, you know, I can't really speculate as to that. All I can do is hang in here and keep fighting. Going over this brief that Susan Howe put together. Again, either she's incompetent or she has trouble comprehending things because there's numerous falsehoods in her written brief here. For example, here's this one part where she's claiming that there were no one with Flagstaff near me. That's completely untrue, and you can see from multiple different camera angles.
You can see in the video. I've seen it myself with my own eyes. Yeah, I've seen it with my own eyes. So she apparently didn't know. Is there a website where people can find out more, watch those videos, and maybe even give you a hand, Michael?
Victoria Taft has done a bang-up job on her website. I think it's just victoriataft.com.
That's where they're posted?
She's kept up with a lot of things since I was banned from talking to the media through a lot of this. My YouTube channel, Laughing at Liberals, bunch of videos, including...
You're not allowed to have that any longer?
Oh, no, I'm allowed to post there again.
Okay.
I was banned from that for a while, but then that was lifted. So, I'm finally able to speak for myself.
Where's the best website for people to find out more? Because I always get that question, Michael.
The Victoria Taft site, my YouTube channel, Laughing at Liberals, and Oregon Firearms Federation. We're all up to speed right now on the legal bills, but a very likely outcome from the appeals court is that this will get remanded back to another trial.
Yep.
Hopefully in a different county. That's one of the things in our appeal here is a change of venue motion that was denied.
Well, Michael, I'm going to invite people to check out the website. Take a look at the videos. I've watched this case from the very beginning. He engaged in self-defense. He ended up convicted of a crime. And now it sounds as though the court system is showing its outward bias against him and in favor of the state. Back in just a moment. Glad to get to your phone calls and emails. And would you let your local electric company, and because it's regulated by the government, meaning the government, control the electricity in your house? I'll give you the details in a second. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm glad to take your phone calls and your emails at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. All this talk about transit, you know what my wild proposal is? I would like to see the transit agencies of the Northwest simply disbanded. It wouldn't happen all at once, but here's how I'd replace them. I'd turn the whole mess over to a couple of different companies. I'd start with Uber and Lyft. I would imagine there would be other innovators out there. And I would say to them, can you figure out a way so that we can efficiently and effectively take people from where they are to where they want to go and do it at a cost that is either equal to or less than the current billions of dollars that Northwest cities are spending on public transit. And I'm willing to bet they could make it happen. I'm willing to bet they could make it and make it a market-driven process. And if you had several different bidders who took over that job, maybe even several bidders within each city, there's nothing that says that everything has to be supplied by one company, but let the companies compete against each other. I'm willing to bet that almost anybody could come up with a better system than spending billions of dollars on light rail, billions of dollars on buses that run empty an awful lot of the day. I'd be willing to bet that we could make one that was more efficient, more effective, got people where they were going, was more convenient, better run at better quality, and with less pollution and less money spent. I'm willing to bet it could be done by private industry. You know that in most of the cities in America, including New York City, transit was not run as a government agency. In fact, transit began to suffer and fall apart when run as a government agency. When it was run as a private business, it was efficient and effective, and it did what the customer needed. Let's go to Dean. Hey, Dean, welcome to the Lars Larson Show. What's on your mind?
I wanted to address the thing about tolls.
Yeah.
I'm a truck driver, and yeah. I used to drive over the road where we did 48 states, and a lot of things go into tolling that I don't think most people realize. One is the increased cost of moving goods in and out of the area that has tolls.
Yeah.
And let's take, for instance, New Jersey, I-95. It's known as the Soprano effect. Out there, if you break down, the only people that are allowed to respond to your breakdown and take care of it are people who are licensed by the authority running the toll roads.
Right, but the toll roads on the East Coast are different than what we're talking about here. In most cases, those toll roads were built with money that is now backed up by the tolls that are charged. Here, they're talking in Seattle. You already have people driving on freeways that they've already paid for with their federal taxes and with their gasoline and diesel and truck taxes. And then they're being told, now that you've paid for it, you have to rent it back to be able to use it. So I want to hear about that more so than I want to hear about the East Coast. The East Coast system does not at all resemble what we have here. So should we accept tolling on roads that the taxpayers of this region have already paid for with their taxes?
Well, how are they going to collect the tolls? Are they going to...
Oh, that's easy. I mean, no, it's easy. Of course it is. You go to Seattle right now. When I visit Seattle, I don't have one of the easy passes in my car because I don't live in the Seattle metro. But when you drive across the, say, the 520 floating bridge, there's a toll for going across the bridge. And if you don't have an easy pass, they snap a picture of your license plate and send you a bill in the mail. If you're a regular commuter there, you have an easy pass, you pay monthly. If you take 10 trips across the bridge, they charge you for 10 trips. So that's already established. In fact, the fact that it's easy to do it electronically is dangerous, because then government can say, why, we can put a toll on almost anything. They're literally talking about tolls in Portland. There has been some talk of tolls on local streets, saying this boulevard is too busy, so let's start charging everybody who drives up at a buck. Well, how do we do that? Well, they're going to have an easy pass because we're going to be tolling them on the freeway, so we're going to toll them that way. And if they don't have an easy pass, we'll snap a picture of their license and send them a bill. So the system for how to collect the money is already there, and it's far less expensive than it's ever been. That's not a good thing. In the old days, to do a toll, they had to have a booth or a bunch of booths with a bunch of people sitting in the booths collecting the money, usually in, you know, silver money as opposed to even paper money. These days, they'll do it electronically, and you'll be charged when you go by at 50 miles an hour. They don't have any problem taking the money out of your pocket. The problem I have is forcing people to pay to rent something back that we've already paid for. And you're listening to the Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you on Conspiracy Theory Thursday. I might mention that several big events are all coming together today. Perhaps the least consequential, it's National Bourbon Day. Then, of course, it's Flag Day for America. And it's also Donald Trump's birthday and the birthday of the United States Army. So what better day to celebrate Conspiracy Theory Thursday than a day like this? A day where We've seen the release of the Inspector General's report. Now, if you've been following this or hearing about this in the news, you say, what the heck is this? Almost every federal agency in Washington, D.C. has an Inspector General's office. All right? The Army does, the Navy does. I mean, they are all over the place. And the whole point of the Inspector General is to look at the things that are done by federal agencies and decide whether they broke the law, wasted money, made stupid decisions. That's what the Inspector General does. And the reports are usually endlessly interesting to read, at least from my point of view. I'll read Inspector General reports on the U.S. Postal Service, on Amtrak, other failed government agencies. You can read Inspector General's report on the IRS, on all kinds of agencies. Well, this particular Inspector General's report was put together and designed to look at one specific investigation. The investigation of Hillary Clinton's use of a secret email server on which she kept classified documents, some of which were leaked, some of which ended up in the hands of what the report today calls foreign actors. Now, we don't know who that is. It could be Korea. It could be Russia. It could be China. It could be a number of foreign actors. But let me point out a couple of the highlights from the report that struck me. Now, remember, this is a 500-page report. If you want to read the whole thing, I've had time to read the executive summary in the roughly 2 hours since it was released. And we also saw there was a little favoritism there as well. The report seemed to have been strategically leaked early on to Bloomberg and a couple of news organizations, but most of us got it around 11 o'clock in the morning Pacific Coast time. Among other things, as John Lott points out, our good friend from the Crime Prevention Research Bureau, now we find out that James Comey, former head of the FBI, fired by Donald Trump, Comey was using a private email account to conduct FBI business at the same time he was investigating Hillary Clinton for doing the same thing, using a private email account. Supposedly, according to Lott, Comey had secret info on his own private email system. You know, as far as I'm concerned, I don't care if you're a Republican or a Democrat. I don't care if you're president or the head of one of the big federal agencies, or a governor, or a mayor, or a senator. I think all of your business for your entity, your agency, an office, you know, an elective office, should be done on the government-owned email system, the government-owned text mail system. All of those systems should be in the public domain. Why? Because among other things, one of the things the public needs to know is what's going on inside that agency. Well, it used to be 30 years ago, you'd go down and you'd look up the documents. You'd look up transcripts of meetings. You'd look up different kinds of forms that had to be filed. You'd look up minutes from a meeting somewhere. You'd look at the city council docket and say, what were they considering and how did these people vote on it? You'd look at all those things. It was all on paper. Today, it's not on paper. It's in computers. And this has now been used against us as citizens because the powers that be, and some of them are Republicans too, have chosen, I want to keep all the things I'm doing out of public view. I want to send messages through back channels. I mean, they basically act like a bunch of drug dealers, some of them, getting burner phones so that they don't have to admit what they're doing. But here are some of the most stunning things out of this report today. Among others, there are two top-ranking FBI officials. Peter Strzok, I know his name looks funny, but it's got a Z in it, but it's pronounced Strzok. Peter Strzok and Lisa Page. Now, they were sleeping with each other, having an affair on company time, apparently, at the FBI. And these are top-level FBI officials. Well, that meant that they were sending a lot of texts to each other. They were like a couple of high school kids. And then a lot of what they said to each other was, you know, about whatever it was they were up to between the sheets. But what they were also saying were things like this. Let me read one of these texts. From Lisa Page to Peter Strzok, and this was on company time. These are some of the parts of this new Inspector General's report. One of them, Lisa Page says, Trump's not ever going to become president, right? And Peter Strzok writes back. Remember, these two are both top-level FBI officials. Peter Strzok writes back, no. No, he won't. We'll stop it. Now, Peter Strzok wasn't just a top-level FBI agent. He was right in the middle of the Hillary Clinton email investigation. Now, I know you're going to hear a real soft-pedaled version of this report. If you turn on the fake stream news on television tonight, if you read it out of the fish wrapper, they're going to say, oh, there's no indication of political bias. Look, Peter Strzok was one of the key investigators right in the middle, top-level official at the FBI. Lisa Page, another top-level official, says to him, Trump's not ever going to become president, right? And Strzok says, no, he won't. We'll stop it. No political bias? Excuse me, folks, nothing to see here. Just move along. Secondly, you might remember that 3 years ago in March of 2015, Hillary Clinton came out and held a news conference. She was under a lot of pressure to talk about why she had this secret email server that we only found out about at the last minute. And, of course, servers that had been wiped, and not with a cloth, as Hillary famously said, wiped so that they were clean of data. And we had to trust that whatever she said was on there was on there. Here is the quote from March 10th, 2015. I did not email any classified material to anyone. There were no security breaches. Well, let's fast forward to June 14th, 2018, today. From the Inspector General's report, foreign actors obtained access to some of Mrs. Clinton's emails, including at least one email classified secret. Meaning, foreign actors could be governments, it could be individuals in foreign countries. Hillary Clinton said she didn't have any secret stuff on those email servers. She did. She said she wasn't hacked. She was. None of it got out of her hands. It did. That's the facts. That's from the report. And then listen to this. An internal email, FBI email, sent in May of 2016, 2 years ago, by Peter Strzok, who was removed from Special Counsel Robert Mueller's Russia probe for demonstrating political bias, which they said there was none of that in the FBI investigation. So apparently the Peter Strzok who engaged in political bias on the Robert Mueller investigation was not engaging in any kind of bias back when he was a top-level FBI agent involved in the email investigation of Hillary Clinton. He corroborates the contents of the memo. We know that foreign actors obtained access to some of Clinton's emails, Strzok wrote in an email obtained by Fox News. So you've got that as well. And then consider this. Documents provided to the committee show foreign actors obtained access to some of Mrs. Clinton's emails, including at least one email classified secret. The private accounts of Clinton staffers were also breached by unnamed foreign actors, according to the memo. The memo notes that the secret classification, which was applied to at least one of the hacked emails, refers to information that, if disclosed, could, quote, reasonably be expected to cause serious damage to national security. So when you hear, oh, this is a nothing burger, this is not anything important at all, they did 500 pages on this, they didn't find any political bias, I'm reading you stuff straight out of the report. Finally, remember, it's 500 pages long. Gowdy, this is Trey Gowdy, talking about the Department of Justice Inspector General report and Peter Strzok. His bias impacted his decision-making, and he assigned himself to the role of stopping the Trump campaign or ending a Trump presidency. Folks, no matter what you hear about the rest of this, I want you to ask yourself to consider this. In a free country where we've always been proud of the way that we transition political power from president to president, from elected senator to outgoing senator to brand new senator, we've always been proud that we have a great system. We now have a system in which one of the major and most powerful agencies of the government, the FBI and the DOJ, conspired to keep President Donald Trump from becoming President Trump. And now we've got a report that says, nah, not that big a deal. Peter Strzok made the promise to Lisa Page in that text. He won't become president. We will stop him. And that's from one of the top officials of the FBI. Now, you tell me there's no political bias going on, or there was none in the FBI. Thank God they fired Comey. Thank God they fired McCabe. Strzok deserves to be punished and prosecuted and put in jail. Lisa Page deserves to get the same. I wish they'd put Comey in jail. And, of course, Hillary has deserved to be in an orange jail pantsuit for a long, long time. Back in just a moment. Glad to be with you. Glad to take your phone calls and emails. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. Glad to be with you and glad to take your phone calls and your emails at 866-HEY-LARS. By the way, I've got a parent who gave me a tip about something that's going on at Alki Middle School in Vancouver. I'd like to find out more. Emails would be helpful. Pictures and screenshots would be even more helpful, and maybe a phone call or two if you know something about what is going on there. My number is 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk@LarsLarson.com. And, of course, we'd like to have you vote in our Twitter poll. The Twitter poll today, should the federal government allow tolls on Northwest freeways? I'm not talking just about the Portland area, but that's lately in the news, but also about the tolls and the expressways in the Seattle area. And you imagine once these jokers get going, is there going to be a federal freeway that they don't want to toll in some community? It seems that once one government figures out a honeypot of money, they want to go after them, all of them, every place they can possibly find it. Let's go to John in Camas. Hey, John, welcome to the Lars Larson Show. What's on your mind today?
Lars, you've absolutely nailed it today on tolling and transportation. Thank you so much.
Well, it's my pleasure.
People need to understand that Portland will be the only place in the nation to add tolls and build absolutely nothing, adding no new capacity. In Seattle on 405, they built new lanes before the tolls. In Virginia on I-66, they added new lanes. Portland just wants to pick the people's pockets and build absolutely nothing, and it's an outrage.
And if you want to know, I mean, I usually get somebody saying, well, then what's your idea? I've got a couple of ideas, and these are ideas that come with concrete numbers. Right now, ODOT, the Oregon Department of Transportation, has almost 5,000 full-time employees and a lot more employees who are seasonal. I don't think they need 5,000 employees, and I base that on an idea I've outlined a few times. New Zealand is a country that is about the size of the state of Oregon. It has about the same culture. That is, it's not a poor place where only rich people have cars. There are a lot of cars there. It has within 10% the same number of lane miles in the country. And a number of years ago, they kind of ran into the brick wall financially. And they said, they had 6,000 people in their Department of Transportation at the time. And they said, let's surplus almost all of them. They kept 600 employees and downsized from 6,000 to 600. So you can see the comparison to Oregon. Weather is similar, culture is similar, roads are similar, topography is similar. And they cut down to about 600 people, and they took the savings that they realized by not having those other 5,400 salaries and benefits, and they used the money to build. They hired private companies, which ODOT does as well. Now, could you imagine an ODOT trimmed down from 5,000 to, say, 2,500, and then take the savings, multiply the average cost of an average employee plus benefits by 2,500 people per year, and imagine the amount of money that you would free up that you could use to spend on roads and improvements? I would also cut almost every single light rail line that's proposed, and I do the same thing in the Seattle area. They're planning to spend $53 billion on light rail to transport a very small percentage of the population while not serving the majority of the population who, whether they like it or not, are going to get around in cars. So in all of these predictions, remember when about 7 or 8 years ago, President Obama would say, we're seeing the end of oil. We have to move away from oil. Well, the fact is, America is sitting on a gold mine of oil right now. We have oil to last the next 100 years. And if electric cars over the next 50 years start to make a bigger dent, they're not much of a dent right now. We have 250 million private automobiles in the United States. And the number I saw just the other day was maybe 2 million of them are electric cars. And they don't make that many electric cars every year. Total production, I think, optimistically, might be a couple of hundred thousand, maybe it's 200,000 or 300,000 per year. Americans buy about 15 or 16 million cars a year. So, you know, right now, electric cars amount to a tiny, tiny fraction of all sales. If they ramped up production and made 1 million electric cars a year and sold every one of them, it would take 250 years at that time to replace all the cars in America with electric cars. Now, I don't doubt that we'll probably see more production. I think maybe within a decade, you might see 1 million cars a year or even a couple of million a year. But when you have 250 million cars and you're putting in 2 million electric cars a year, do the math on how long it's going to take before electric cars are even a sizable minority of the automobiles, let alone a majority of the automobiles. It's not going to happen anytime soon. So you still have, and with electric cars, you still have to have roads for them to drive on. And this region seems to have elected officials who are happy to leave all of us stuck in major traffic jams most of the day. And that just isn't, that's not something that works. You're not serving the public by doing that. So I've given you my solid idea for doing it. And I wouldn't also have a problem, as Newt Bueller said, the candidate for governor who's going to replace Kate Brown this fall. He says, look, if you want to build a brand new bridge across the Columbia River, go ahead and do it and put a toll on that to pay for it. I'm not against that if it's an extraordinary expenditure. But I think we could have built a good bridge across that river for less than $1 billion. And if you had each state pay half, and that seems fair, even if you didn't get a dime from the feds, for $1 billion, you build a brand new bridge. And I've compared this to other bridges that have been built recently in other parts of the United States. So I have a good reason for saying $1 billion would do the job. If half $1 billion was paid by Washington and half $1 billion by Oregon, and you said it's a long-term investment, let's bond it out over 30 years. Then you take $500 million divided by 30 years, and you're not talking about that much money per year that you could get by firing a whole bunch of the people at ODOT. Now, do you think the math on that holds together?
Absolutely right. It's a great idea. We had Fig Engineering out here offer a fixed-price bridge contract for one crossing the Columbia River for $850 million a couple of years ago.
There,
so your
go.
Numbers are right on the money.
$850 million. And if you imagine this. What if you built that bridge and said, we're going to have this be a privately owned bridge, owned by a bridge authority. New York State has had bridge authorities, and it will collect a toll, but then maybe you don't have to build it at prevailing wage costs. And you don't have to build it with some of the other razzmatazz that goes every time you build something under the auspices of government. And then let the private entity, the private bridge authority that operates that bridge, collect the money back from the people who use the bridge over 30 or 40 or 50 years. And it all pencils out. You've got the Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm glad to get your phone calls and your emails at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk@LarsLarson.com. Bernie Giusto joins me now, retired county sheriff from Multnomah County. Bernie, you've had a chance to take a look at some of the reporting that's been done in the couple of hours since the Inspector General's report was released regarding the Clinton email investigation. I've already told my listeners some of what I saw in that report and some of the high points I saw. I want you to hit the points that you thought were significant.
Well, I think, first of all, Lars, just a word out to the FBI agents around this country that I've worked with directly in many cases, from child homicides to counterterrorism kind of things, and do great work. And today is a very sad day for them, because really this rests on the shoulder of the leadership of the FBI and then the Department of Justice. So let's start with the fact that the IG came to the clear conclusion that Director Comey was insubordinate when he supposedly, and I'm still not buying this entirely, didn't tell his superiors, which was Loretta Lynch, the Department of Justice director, that he intended to make this pronouncement about the Clinton emails and whether or not they're going to be charged in this. And just for a quick review, you know, the Department of Justice works with the FBI, but clear in terms of the command authority is over the FBI in terms of structure. In my mind, it's a poor structure, because it'd be like the sheriff working for the district attorney every day, and answering to district attorney whether things were going to be investigated or not. And so the insubordination charge that the IG says is very evident in what he didn't do is why, in fact, it may be that Rod Rosenstein, the current and then deputy director of the Department of Justice, recommended to the president, we forget, he's the one who recommended firing Comey. Whether or not that was the exact reason, it had to be some of the reason. But what's, I think, been lost so far in the discussion is, if this was such an outrageous subterfuge of process in the Department of Justice, and that between that and the FBI, where was the outrage by Loretta Lynch or President Obama in either removing Comey or sanctioning him somehow? He just floated right into the next Trump term with no concern at all about what he'd done. So I'm not buying necessarily that there was no political bias, which, of course, the IG says, at that stage of the investigation.
Well, I got to tell you something, Bernie. I think the no political bias is hogwash. And let me suggest why. Two of the key people at the high levels of the FBI were Lisa Page and Peter Strzok, who had some kind of sexual relationship going on. So they were swapping thousands and thousands of text messages it almost seems from the number of text messages that these two didn't do anything at the FBI. All they did was sit there and send text messages to each other all day long. I think the number was somewhere in the range of 50,000 text messages between these two lovers. But at one point, Lisa Page says to Strzok by text message, "Trump's not ever going to become president, right? Right?" And she asks it twice. Strzok replies, "No, no, he won't. We'll stop it." Now, I want to know what Americans should think, Bernie, when somebody who's in the top levels of an investigatory law enforcement agency, the FBI, says, "We're going to stop a man from becoming president of the United States."
Well, that's clear what Americans should be concerned about. You know, that email you brought up today is the first time that it's been outed is in this report. It was from an August 6th communication between the two. And it's at that point the report that the IG just submitted says that there are clear indications of political bias then. The ones he said early on about, in fact the investigation about Comey's incompetence and insubordination was much prior to this August 6th, 2016. And I'm going to tell you that he brought in a mop-up team, the IG did, to go take a look for any other things they may have missed in these communications. And that mop-up team, FBI agents, are the ones that came up with this particular email yet to be dealt with. But I will tell you going forward that this afternoon that the FBI director, Christopher Wray, will be speaking to the public at 5:30 Eastern time, and he'll be talking about the investigation. Expect that Peter Strzok, who has been relegated to the HR closet of the FBI, is on his way out and going to be fired in the next several days without any question. And after that, I think we'll see where the political will of the Congress is.
Well, I know, Bernie, that they say that a fish rots from the head down, but I'm wondering how far down does the rot go? Because Comey was clearly acting in a political manner. I mean, this is the guy who walked into a meeting, several meetings with Donald Trump, deliberately took notes about the meetings, and then when he didn't see the kind of investigation of President Trump that he wanted to see, he deliberately leaked them in violation of the law to reporters to create stories that he himself testified he hoped would generate a special investigation of Donald Trump. So this is a guy who was acting politically. Page and Strzok were political. McCabe was acting politically. You've just said that Rod Rosenstein was acting politically, and yet they put Peter Strzok right in the middle of the Mueller investigation, and he got fired from that for acting politically. How far down does this political rot go in an agency that's supposed to be agnostic with regard to politics?
Well, let's start with the fact that the leaks that have come out of this investigation have come from FBI agents. Don't be misled by that. Wherever the media got things that were not favorable to the FBI came right out of that agency from ground level people who'd had enough of what they're seeing by 5, 6, 8, 10 top leading people. And it should worry greatly the American people that it only takes 5 out of 10,000, 20,000 to have this kind of result in terms of the abuse of power in agencies like this. And having run organizations, I can tell you, nobody at the top gets to say, "I didn't know," because in running organizations, they know or should have known or know and just don't want to say anything about it. And I think the next guy in the crosshairs is Rosenstein. I think he's got problems, if not immediately, pretty soon. And if Sessions doesn't do something, he's right behind him.
Well, and you know that Rosenstein, just the other day, it comes out that Rosenstein sat there with members of Congress and said, either back off from the FBI, or I'm going to throw a pile of subpoenas at you. I mean, this is a guy in a federal agency that's supposed to be under the oversight of Congress and under the control of the DOJ, which itself is controlled by the president, and he's threatening members, you know, the people who are supposed to be there representing us.
They were staff people at that, not just Devin Nunes, the head of the Intelligence Committee, but his staff people. He wouldn't name who it was, but the fact of the matter is this is the kind of behavior that the American people had enough of, and that's why President Trump's here. I expect President Trump to do a couple things almost initially here immediately. He's going to order at some point the release of the documents that the FBI won't release at this point, and he has every right to tell his Attorney General and people under him, "I want him out. I want him out tomorrow. I don't want to talk about it."
He can declassify anything anything he wants, can he?
That's correct. And the other thing about it is, don't forget that this document that we just saw could have been laundered a little bit on the way out the door by people at the Department of Justice. In fact, they had already read it and were in briefing the president during the release of this information. So I'm not saying they did, but I'm not saying that it's beyond...
They may have sanitized this to a considerable degree. The same way Loretta Lynch, we've known this for a while, but she told Comey, don't refer to Hillary's the investigation of Hillary as an investigation. Call it a matter. And even he questioned that. I mean, could you imagine when you were sheriff, if the county commission had called you up and some member of the chair of the county commission had said, hey, by the way, Bernie, when you're investigating Lars Larson, don't call it an investigation. Call it a matter.
Yeah, right. You know? That was going nowhere with me, let alone the credibility inside my agency. And that's what I'm saying, that the FBI and people, Department of Justice, that are serving this country well, have got to be just destroyed today in terms of what they believe they came to do in this profession.
Well, how much do we have to chop off of the top of this agency to get it cleaned up again so that people, the good people at the bottom, can do their jobs?
Well, it's not just this agency. It's those agencies. Yeah. That's the Department of Justice and FBI. They are separate only in function, not in political reality. And so, again, that structure of government needs to be changed. And it's up to the department. It's actually up to the president to change that if he wanted to have a different reporting line. It probably will never happen in our lifetime. But until you take the prosecutors out of the pocket of the investigators, you're looking for trouble.
Bernie, I want to ask you about one other thing. Yesterday, I get a lot of DOJ press releases that come across through email. And one of them was talking about a guy, I think he was down in Texas or Oklahoma. He'd been in the military. When he left the military, he left with a pile of paperwork that was part of his job in the military. He then went to work in the private defense industry. And some of those papers were kind of valuable to him, and he shouldn't have taken them. They were illegally taken, and he violated the law by doing it. He just got sent to prison for close to 5 years for doing that because he took classified information and it was released. Well, Hillary Clinton, all the way back 3 years ago, was saying, I did not email classified material to anyone. There were no security breaches. Well, the report today says foreign actors, meaning countries or individuals, obtained access to some of Mrs. Clinton's emails, including at least one email classified as secret. And they went on to say that the memo says that the secret classification to one of the hacked emails, quote, could reasonably be expected to cause serious damage to national security if disclosed. Now, given all that, how does Jim Comey lawman hold a press conference and say no reasonable prosecutor would find that there was any violation of the law by Mrs. Clinton when she did the same thing that the guy I just mentioned who got sentenced this week to 5 years in prison? She did the same thing. She sent classified information. It got hacked, and it ended up in the hands of foreign nationals. They could be China. They could be Russia. They could be anybody. But her stuff got hacked. She knew it. They knew it a year ago. So how is it that Comey can say, no, Hillary didn't break any laws?
I'll tell you, it's along with the that report goes on to say that the staff computers were as well hacked in that situation, and although they didn't point to exactly what. And we'll remember that President Trump just forgave the sailor from the nuclear submarine from
for a couple of photos he took.
Right, exactly. Yeah. So there's no rhyme or reason to this, and it's why the American public, no matter what people think in terms of their ability to absorb this kind of stuff, have had enough of this kind of dishonesty. And I'm going to tell you, it really does undermine the authority of government to act in our behalf every day, and especially law enforcement, that we have one thing to sell, it's trust and trust alone. That's it. And without that, there is no function for public safety.
Absolutely right. Bernie, thank you so much.
Thanks.
That's former County Sheriff Bernie Giusto with us. Back in just a moment. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show. All right, folks, I do what I can, but I got to make a little bit of a Hail Mary today, and here's what it is. I get tips from listeners all the time, and all I know about this tip is that we've called the Sheriff's Department in Clark County. We've called the Police Department in Clark County. The Sheriff's Department confirms there is something going on at Alki Middle School. I would like to find out what it is, but the Sheriff's Department won't give anything up. We've called the school, and they won't give anything up. We've made the call to the school district's public information officer. Oftentimes, the public information officers are the least informative people you can talk to, but they do have a job and they do have a pension to earn, so God bless them. So I get this email from Eric. It says, Lars, I just wanted you to know, my kids attend Alki Middle School in Vancouver, and today there was a threat by a student. A student was beaten up after school yesterday at a park near the school. There were rumors going around, rumors that the kid's older brother had guns and he was going to come after the other kid in a fight. Today, the kid that was beaten up posted on Instagram and Snapchat that today was a good day for a school shooting. Multiple kids took screenshots and showed administrators at the school. I just spoke to my daughter, and there are three police officers on site right now, and they've arrested the student that made the threat. Not sure the status of the older brother. I told my daughter to make sure she tells everyone they did the right thing. You saw something and you said something. My wife called the school and they said they're taking care of everything. They wouldn't give any details. My daughter said that they are not on lockdown. The campus is a closed campus, but I'm concerned that when school is out, I'm going to the school right now to pick up my kids just in case. Now, all I have there is a tip. I got that about 45 minutes ago. And I didn't share it with you till I had taken the time to call the school, call the police, call the public information officer. They're not giving up anything. So I'm asking you, if you know something more about this situation, I would love to know about it by email, by a phone call to us, 866-439-5277. And these days when the schools say, oh, don't worry, we'll take care of everything. Sorry to say, but that's what they did with Nicholas Cruz. They took care of Nicholas Cruz's little threats and his warnings to other students and all that. They took care of it for a long time. They buried it. And the FBI ignored it at the time, not once but twice. And so I don't necessarily trust that the schools have everything well in hand. But I want to know what's going on at Alki Middle, and I will find out one way or the other. I probably won't find out from our government first. I'll probably find out from private citizens. Let's go to Eric in Corvallis. Hey, Eric, welcome to the program.
Yeah, afternoon, Lars.
Afternoon.
Yeah, I'm on a speakerphone. I can't get off.
The producers told you, though, you can't do a speakerphone. That just doesn't work. So we'll fix that up or otherwise. Let's go to Jim in Spanaway, Washington. Hey, Jim, welcome to the Lars Larson Show.
Hey, Lars. A lot of this stuff has probably been, you probably reiterated, but federal I-5 was built with Federal Highway Trust Fund money. That means every person across the country owns it, put money into that highway.
That's true.
Put a toll on it is double taxation. If there was private bonds, then they could have built with private bonds, then they could charge the toll. But Pennsylvania tried it with Interstate 80. Texas tried it. They were shot down. Washington thinks that the federal government is going to give in and let them toll the road, then every country or every state across the country is going to do the same thing, which will also raise the price of interstate transportation, and it's going to be passed on to the consumer and groceries and every other commodity that is involved.
You're absolutely right, and that's why we've asked the Trump administration to come on the show, too, and talk about whether they'll say yes. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. Glad to be with you and glad to take your phone calls and emails at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk@larslarson.com. I want to tell you something that I think most reporters in America don't seem to understand. A lot of them think of coal as this icky, ugly way of making electricity. They also think of it as maybe they're thinking of something out of Dickens. You know, or maybe out of a Christmas Carol where, you know, Bob Cratchit saying, can we put another lump of coal on the stove? And, you know, that kind of thing. And that's not what it is. Coal supplies about a third of America's electricity right now. Now, you can think of it as old fashioned or outmoded or highly polluting or whatever you want to think of it. But there is an effort right now in the U.S. Energy Department under Secretary Perry to try to make sure that we keep coal plants online, because whether you like it or not, this country has to supply a massive grid, and solar and wind and all the other alternatives don't really supply much of anything. It's a few percentage points of the entire grid, and coal still supplies a massive amount of it. So there's been a controversy lately that the Trump administration has said, we need to keep these coal plants online. That means we have to buy electricity that's coming out of the plants. Otherwise, the plants are going to go away, and we're not going to have it anymore. So I thought, to be able to have an intelligent conversation about subsidies, because this is the accusation you're hearing. Well, but you're talking about subsidizing coal. And folks say, but coal plants are too expensive. They're mostly too expensive because of some of the crazy federal requirements that have been put on top of them. So I thought I'd get a guy on the line who actually knows something about it, unlike me, Dr. James Konka, who is a senior scientist with UFA Ventures and actually makes his home here in the Pacific Northwest, just like me. Dr. Konka, thank you very much for taking the time.
Oh, you're welcome. This is great.
Well, I wanted you to kind of lay it out, and feel free to go where you want with it, but the accusation is, gosh, we've got all these wonderful renewables. Why do we need this old-fashioned coal? And after all, you're talking about subsidizing coal, and by that, either requiring utilities to buy coal from coal-fired power plants that cost more to run, mostly, and test me on this if I'm wrong about it, they mostly cost a lot more money to run these days because the federal government has put a lot more requirements on the plants and the plant operators to run them clean and all that. So tell me what your take is on this whole situation and whether we should keep those coal plants online and available to the grid, or should we let them go away, hoping to replace them someday, I guess, with solar and wind, which doesn't sound very realistic to me.
Well, yeah, so the problem is solar and wind are screaming up if you look at the percent numbers, but in actuality, the actual amount of energy they're producing isn't very much, and it's not coming up fast enough. So you can't start closing, you know, reliable energy sources like coal and nuclear and hydro and gas without having something ready to take its place. Otherwise, you're just, you know, gambling for blackouts. And the regional transmission operators who control the grid now, like in New England or New York, are basically saying that if you close nuclear and coal and expect to get more hydro from Quebec and expect to get more gas from Pennsylvania and south, then you need to put in high voltage transmission lines, you need to put in gas pipelines, and the public always votes those down. So we're headed for a crisis, and that's not very good. And so the grid is a funny thing. No one wants to talk about the grid and how it works, but it really works very close to its max. So you really can't lose a bunch of energy or gain a bunch of energy, you know, in hours, because that totally upsets the grid, and then you start getting blackouts and surges and things like that. And it also costs a lot of money to do that. So right now, the idea of subsidizing coal and nuclear, and we're only talking about a cent, okay, per kilowatt hour, which is not very much. Whereas, you know, solar and wind get a lot more than that. They get up to 10 cents a kilowatt hour, and no one seems to care about that. So that's the funny thing about subsidies. Subsidies move the cost from the ratepayer to the taxpayer, okay? So in the end of the month, your bill comes in, and maybe you're paying 7 cents a kilowatt hour like we are up here, or 8 cents a kilowatt hour, or in New York you're paying 19 cents a kilowatt hour. If you subsidize that, that just lowers the cost of the ratepayer, but it puts it on the taxpayer. And I don't know whether you think that's great or wonderful or not, but to me the ratepayer needs to be paying because we're the ones using it.
Well, I agree with that, although Dr. Konka, I always knew in high school that when they taught us Venn diagrams, that someday I'd find a use for them. And I think I have a use for them now. If I drew a Venn diagram circle and it had all of the ratepayers in it, and then I drew another Venn diagram circle that had all the taxpayers in it, do you think you could tell the difference between the two circles? Because I think they're going to overlap a lot, aren't they?
Somewhat, yeah. Except that it depends on where you live. Like right now, again, we in the Pacific Northwest pay about 8 cents a kilowatt hour, which is the cheapest in the country and in most of the world.
Sure.
Because we have so much hydro, we have nuclear, we have some wind, but it's mainly hydro, so it's fairly cheap. Whereas if someone in New York is paying a tax and we're paying a tax, it's a different percentage of our use. So again, the ratepayer Venn circle actually scales with the amount of use and with the price at that area, whereas the taxpayer is just all over the place. It just spreads it out. So if you have a subsidy, we in the Pacific Northwest pay more of that subsidy tax-wise than someone in New York.
That's a good point. Now, one of the things, I've read a bunch of the pieces you've written for Forbes magazine, And I thought they were instructive because, Doctor, one of the things that I hear from people is, well, you know, we've been working on solar and they're getting more efficient and they're getting the cost down. And I thought, I don't think that's true. We've been working on solar since the 1950s when it was primarily electricity for spacecraft and satellites. And we've gotten a lot better. But and we can make it somewhat cheaper. But the numbers you used in one of the pieces you wrote recently, you said in 2010 and 2011, the actual cost of solar electricity was 100 cents per kilowatt hour. It's a buck. And yes. and that, as you said, the retail cost, not the wholesale cost, but the retail cost of electricity in the Northwest is less than 10 cents. So if we switch to entirely solar, for example, if we had the sun to do it with, you'd see people's electric bills in this region go up tenfold. And even in New York City, you'd see them go up fivefold, 500%, if we were entirely on solar. So when people see those as economic alternatives, I know you point out that in 2013 and 2014, they got the price to 80 cents per kilowatt hour. But coal and nuclear and those are all the way down around a nickel, you know, in some cases less. So if they don't want to preserve these coal-fired plants, it's not just going to have a risk to the grid that we could have blackouts and brownouts and really a bad situation where there just isn't electricity when you flip on the switch, but the cost is likely to go up dramatically, isn't it?
Yes, and this gets back to profit, you know, profit margins and profitability. There's two different things. The renewables, you know, wind and solar, all of their cost is upfront. It's all in construction, okay? And it's a huge amount of money per megawatt installed for wind and solar, and they only last about 20 years. So again, it's a huge, it's all upfront construction. Once it's built, then that's where they're great because they have no fuel, right? Now, they're intermittent, and you have to have something else come on and off as they go up and down, but still, once they're built, and they're expensive to build, but once they're built, there's no fuel cost. So whereas, you know, coal and nuclear and gas, there's a fuel cost once they're built, and then the cost, in fact, per megawatt hour is not that much, and they last a long time. Nuclear lasts 60 to 80 years. So you only build it once. But again, you have some fuel costs, you have operation costs, maintenance costs, and those all come in at a different time period in the unit's life, okay? So once they're built, then you say, well, what is the cost to run it, okay? And for wind, it's about 2.5 cents, you know, a kilowatt hour to operate once it's built. Solar, it's a little bit less actually. And then nuclear is about 4 to 5 cents a kilowatt hour. Coal is about 5 to 6 cents a kilowatt hour. Gas is about 3 to 4 cents a kilowatt hour. So again, they're all in about the same range. But when you give wind and solar a subsidy, their operation costs drop below zero. So that's called negative pricing. So you can't compete with that. And so it's kind of funny. And it's like, oh, my God, you can't make any money against wind and solar if they have the subsidy because they essentially can give it away for free.
Because all the cost was paid up front by the taxpayer.
Right. During construction. Yep.
Yeah. So.
So again, now you have a nuclear plant that is just marginal, like, you know, Pilgrim was and Vermont Yankee. And so. And the Apple Canyon in California, so you they're operating at 4 to 5 cents a kilowatt hour, and here comes wind in at zero or -2 sometimes, and it's like, well, of course you're going to take that energy first because it's the cheapest, and that's the issue. Unfortunately, you need other power plants to keep to buffer or load follow the intermittency of wind and solar. And if they're not making any money, yeah, they're going to shut down because they're not making any money. And it's not it's not corporations' job to save America. Right? It's their job to make money.
Yeah.
So if they're not making any money, then they're going to close it down. And then you're stuck because you have nothing else to buffer the wind and solar. And now you start having problems with blackouts and the grid can't deal with it because we don't have a very modern grid. Our grid is over 50 years old, most of it.
By the way, Doc, can I ask you about one other issue while we've got time? And that is this. People say, well, but someday, if we just keep subsidizing it long enough, we'll get solar and wind down to where they are competitive with fossil fuels. Is that at all? Is that true in actuality? Can you actually get the installed cost of solar and wind down low enough so that you can effectively someday drop the subsidies and they'll be competitive? Or are they always going to be somewhat higher?
They'll always be somewhat higher because the materials cost. I mean, wind takes about 10 times the amount of steel per megawatt hour as nuclear and coal and gas. I mean, 10 times the amount of steel. Each of those wind turbines takes up to 1,000 tons of steel and 1,000 tons of concrete to build. That's huge, and it doesn't produce much power.
And by the way, there's an energy cost to that, too, right? So when you talk about energy footprint, if you take 10 times as much steel, the steel doesn't come for free. It comes at the cost of digging it out of the ground, which takes energy, smelting it and melting it and forming it, which takes energy. So 10 times the steel is not just a money cost, it's also an energy cost as well.
Yes, and that's why, you know, wind and nuclear have the same carbon footprint. Because of that, okay? Solar's carbon footprint is about five times that.
So Doc, unfortunately, I've got to break. That's Dr. James Konka, who's an independent scientist, senior scientist at UFA Ventures. We've been talking about subsidies and energy, and you've got the Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm glad to get your phone calls and your emails at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk@larslarson.com. Do you know all the warnings that I've given you where I'm concerned about the idea that there might be another incident like Parkland, Florida, at Douglas High School, where the school ignored warning signs of Nicholas Cruz, and eventually Nicholas Cruz came to school and he murdered 17 people? Well, about an hour and a half ago, I got a message from a parent. I don't know the parent, but the parent was concerned. He was going to pick up his children at school, and here's why. His children said that a boy was beaten up at the school yesterday and that that boy had sent out a message by social media indicating today's a good day for a school shooting. Now, the parent was concerned, but he said the kids did the right thing. They took screenshots of that message. They reported it to the school authorities, and the school authorities were taking action. So here's what I got. It was at Alki Middle School. And this is where I think they're following the same path that the Parkland, Florida schools followed, because that school saw threat after threat after threat from Nicholas Cruz, and they handled it internally. They did not call the cops. Nicholas Cruz was never charged with a crime before he murdered 17 people. Here's the message from the principal, Darcy Franck, and we are trying to get Darcy Franck on the line right now. Dear Alki families, today, June 14th, we learned that an Alki student made a threatening statement via social media. That was the statement I told you about. Today's a good day for a school shooting. She goes on. We immediately notified the Clark County Sheriff's Office, good, who investigated the statement and took appropriate action. We don't know what that is. Did they arrest the student? And here's where they get into the government baloney that you get all the time. She writes, while confidentiality laws prohibit us from discussing all the details, please know that we are working hard to keep our students and staff members safe, and we will continue to take every step necessary to ensure safety. Let me tell you why I call BS on this. She does not have to tell us the name of the student. But if she were to say the student has been arrested, and we've been given to understand from the sheriff's office that he has been arrested, if he was charged, she could indicate that he is charged initially, that he will, you know, face some consequences. But she doesn't say that. She just says, hey, we've taken appropriate action and take our word for it. It'll be fine. She said, we do not believe there is a continued threat or safety risk to our school, to err on the side of caution. However, we have additional district resource officers to maintain security on the Chinook, Alki, and Skyview campuses tomorrow. Thank you to the students who brought the statement to the administrator's attention. We urge everyone to remember, if you see something, say something. If you have any questions, call the school office. And she gives the number and her name. I would love to have her come on. Because my concern is that the schools in Washington State, like the schools in Oregon, are following a program called restorative justice. In Florida, they called it the Promise Program. And essentially, it came down to, until you kill somebody, we're not going to refer you to law enforcement. In this case, law enforcement was called, and that is a good move. But will this student face any kind of real legal consequences, end up in front of a judge? This one might. But I have this concern that the parents are being told virtually nothing. Now, schools always complain that they wish parents would be more involved in the schools. And then when there's an opportunity to be involved and to be told some real information, you are treated like a mushroom. You're kept in the dark and you're fed manure. In this case, we're told, just take our word for it. Whatever it was we did about it, we can't tell you what we did about the problem, but take our word for it. We've handled it. It's okay. No more need to worry. And we're not going to tell you the details. And you're listening to the Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. Glad to be with you on Conspiracy Theory Thursday. And let me share this with you. It's a little bit like watching sausage get made. But almost 2 hours ago, I get an alert from a parent who says there's something going on at Alki Middle School. He says the students there became aware that one of the students who'd been beaten up the day before had sent out social media messages saying, today is a good day for a school shooting. Now, that's clearly a threatening message. Now, the school has communicated to the parents, but only to say something happened. The police were called. Something was done. Take our word for it. It's all taken care of. Oh, and by the way, thanks to the kids for coming forward. If you see something, say something. I get that. So the principal, Darcy Franck, put in her message, if you want to know more, call us. I've had the unpleasant experience of talking to too many parents who, when they call the school says, we can't tell you anything, and we're not going to tell you anything. And they always say it's about privacy. Now, the fact is that we know from the sheriff's department that a student was arrested at the school. Apparently, the school doesn't want to say that, but the sheriff's department will tell us that. Do we know anything more about that? No. Am I going to put the student's name on the air? Middle school? No. I don't think I'd put the student's name on the air at this point. If he's charged with something serious, here's the problem, though, when they hold back the name. When I decide a week or two from now to say, I wonder what happened to that case. Did they end up bringing charges against somebody for making a threat against a school? Well, you can't find out because you don't know the name of the person who is involved. So there is a little bit of a problem not knowing the name. And the fact that the school will not share the information, even when we called the number where it said, if you want to know more information, call us up, Darcy Franck, referred us off to the public information officer. And we have had a call in for more than an hour to the public information officer. Still no information coming there either. Do you think I'm going to hold my breath while I wait for an answer? Yeah, probably not. Back to your calls at 866-HEY-LARS. That's eight. Oh, let me do this for just a moment. The current head of the FBI, Christopher Wray, is holding a press conference right now. I'm going to join that in progress because he's responding to the IG, the Inspector General's report that just came out a few hours ago.
Any evidence of political bias or improper considerations actually impacting the investigation under review?
Hogwash.
The report does identify errors of judgment, violations of or even disregard for policy, and decisions that, at the very least, with the benefit of hindsight, were not the best choices. We've already started taking the necessary steps to address those issues. First, we're going to hold employees accountable for any potential misconduct. We've already referred conduct highlighted in the report to our disciplinary arm, OPR, which is the FBI's independent Office of Professional Responsibility. We need to hold ourselves accountable for the choices we make and the work we do. We're doing that fairly, but without delay, in the way that people should expect.
You know, that's Christopher Wray, the current head of the FBI. This is hogwash. No evidence of political bias. Now, I've already told you what Lisa Page and Peter Strzok had to say to each other by text messages, and they were high-ranking FBI officials. Strzok was actually assigned to the Mueller investigation until he was fired from the investigation. Why? Because of political bias. And he and his paramour, Lisa Page, exchanged messages, one of which I mentioned is particularly telling. Page says, well, Donald Trump isn't really going to get elected, right? Right? And Peter Strzok's response, no. No, he's not. We're not. We will stop him. That was the response. Here's a further exchange of messages from attorney FBI Attorney 1 to employee. So that's Strzok and Page. I am numb. The other says, I can't stop crying. That makes me even more sad. Like, what happened? You promised me this wouldn't happen. You promised. Okay, that might have been a lie. I'm very upset. Ha ha. I'm so stressed about what I could have done differently. That's the FBI's attorney. That's Lisa Page. I am so stressed about what I could have done differently. No bias, right, Director Ray? The FBI employee, who I believe is Peter Strzok, responds, don't stress. None of that mattered. The FBI's influence. I don't know. We broke the momentum. That is not so. And the response comes back, all the people who were initially voting for her would not and were not be swayed by any decision the FBI put out. They're talking about Hillary. Trump's, listen to this, from FBI employee, who I have every reason to believe is Peter Strzok, texting back, Trump's supporters are all poor to middle class, uneducated, lazy POS. If you need to have a, you know, explanation of POS, look it up on the internet. I can't say it on the air. That he think he will magically grant them jobs for doing nothing. No, that's Democrats that do that. They probably didn't watch the debates, aren't fully educated on his policies, and are stupidly wrapped up in his unmerited enthusiasm. Now, tell me again, these are two high-ranking FBI officials. These folks aren't on even the bottom end of the FBI. The individual agents are all highly trained, highly educated people. The folks at the top of the agency, like Strzok and Page, their attitude toward Donald Trump's constituents, people like me, is, well, you're just a bunch of dumb, uneducated POS who think that Donald Trump is going to magically grant them jobs for doing nothing. No, not for doing nothing. Donald Trump has been bringing jobs back to this country like crazy. The current economy is growing at 4% GDP, more than twice the rate it grew at during all 8 years of the Barack Obama administration. But the attitude of the FBI, these two top FBI officials, is you and I are a bunch of uneducated, lazy, good-for-nothing POS. Now, tell me again how there's no political bias at the top levels of the FBI. Director Ray, I think that is a bunch of hogwash. Let's go to Lois in Goldendale, Washington. Hey, Lois, welcome to the Lars Larson Show.
Hi, Lars. Thanks for taking my call.
My pleasure. What's on your mind?
Well, I just wanted to raise another perspective as in regards to that, I'm assuming, boy, the student that made the threat on social media regarding
the paper shooting.
All right, that is, early on, I heard mentioned that a student had been beaten up, and I'm assuming that the boy or the child that made the threat or inference was the student that had been beaten up.
Yeah, I should have made that clearer, but from the original email from the parent, he said a boy was beaten up at school yesterday, and then today at school, there were social media messages sent out, Snapchat or Instagram or whatever, and that said, today is a good day for a school shooting, and the other students took screenshots of that message and then immediately or fairly quickly took it to school administrators who acted and called the police. I think all of that is perfectly appropriate, but it was
the
kid who was beaten up who apparently issued the threats.
And that's where I wanted to back up just a little bit. I'm agreeing with everything that you're saying. I think this does need to be, all that needs to be brought into the fore, but we can't just stop there.
Yeah.
I feel we need to go back a little bit further and like this child was beaten up, that needs to look into, and justice needs to be done, and repercussions need to be dealt out, I feel, on those lines as well, so that, that students, and I'm not saying this is the only cause for student shootings, but that there is justice, and kids aren't left with the only feeling that, well, now I have to reach out and at least start threatening, if not start.
I agree with you. And here's the only thing I'd hold back on, because I don't know and because the school won't say. I don't know whether this is a school bully who finally got somebody who would fight back, or if this was a victim who was just set upon by a bunch of, because you know that it could have gone both ways. I've seen school bullies who finally bullied somebody enough and his victim finally decided to fight back, or it could have been somebody who was being beaten up by others. But it really suggests that the schools are not running a tight ship when it comes to discipline or to try to control these kinds of activities. I don't want to see kids beaten up, but I also don't want to see kids with their hands tied where they're told by the school, if you fight back, if you defend yourself, you will be punished just as severely as the one who's, you know, who assaulted you. And I don't think that makes sense either. Do you?
I do not, but then it goes back to the we really don't, like you pointed out, we don't really know exactly what happened. So I did approach this phone call from the perspective that somebody innocent that had been targeted got beat up and he's had too much. And you're right, that may not be the case at all. That's the path that my mind took me on. But regardless of what, I hope that that's looked into by the students.
By the way, we just got word, I want to interrupt you, we just got word from the Clark County Sheriff's Office. Students sent a text message via Snapchat stating, quote, perfect day for a school shooting to another student who alerted authorities. A Clark County resource deputy responded, conducted an investigation. The 14-year-old male student was taken into custody and booked into the juvenile detention facility for felony harassment and disrupting school activities and threatening to bomb or injure at a building. There was no active threat and the school was not placed in lockdown. Right there, the sheriff's office gave out the information the school could have given out and chose not to. Now, I think in this case, maybe we're seeing a change from that promise program restorative justice nonsense that created, helped to create the phenomena of Nicholas Cruz in Florida. I'm worried that we don't want to repeat that because we should have learned from what happened there. They ignored Nicholas Cruz making threats like this, and he made threats that were worse than this one. He threatened, to leave students bleeding and dying in the grass at the school. And this was long before the shooting on Valentine's Day. And the FBI was told about Nicholas Cruz in September of the previous year, told again in January of this year, and did nothing. The school knew that this guy was threatening, and they had actually restricted his access to school. They told him he couldn't bring a backpack to school because he brought bullets and knives to school previously. But they took no meaningful action. They didn't call the cops, as Alki Middle School did. So congratulations to Alki for doing that. But I don't want to see us make the same mistake the Florida folks did with the Broward Sheriff's Office by not letting the police do what they're supposed to do. Educators are not criminal justice experts. And, you know, and we don't expect cops to be teachers, and we don't expect teachers to be cops. So when something like this that's criminal happens, calling the cops is the perfect thing to do.
But yeah, no argument there. No argument there at all. I was just hoping that, that the beating up incident would be looked into as well.
Absolutely. And I hope they do. And I hope they make it clear. We're not going to allow this. And the first time we see somebody step out of line and hit somebody else, that person, we're going to call the cops. I think a ride in a cop car can straighten out almost anybody's head at a certain age. After a certain point, the kid probably looks at it as a point of pride. Yeah, I was in juvie. No big deal. You don't want the kid to get to that point where he's thinking of, you know, being with the cops or being under arrest or being in front of a judge is no big deal. I'd love to see those kids become solid citizens and straighten out their ways. But if they're not willing to do that, I don't want to let them run around to school until they decide to kill somebody like Nicholas Cruz did. Thank you, Lois. I appreciate the call. Back in just a moment. You've got the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. There's nothing like having a public employee of a school district that you pay taxes to, who is the public information officer, saying we are not going to give you any more information about what happened at Alki School. We actually got more from the sheriff's department than we got from anyone else, and I find that interesting. And I guess it doesn't surprise me, given that I hear from so many parents who want to be involved in their kids' schools and who are told, yeah, you can be involved, but we're really not interested in your input. You might be able to come down and sort papers for us or something like that, but really, we're not going to have much to do with you, and we're not going to tell you what's going on. And that's a sad statement. By the way, I got another email, and this gentleman may be right. He says, it may not be that the school called the cops. It may be that one of the parents got a call from one of the kids, and that could have happened as well. You're entirely right. Let me go to, let's go to Jerry in Renton, listening on Talk Radio 570 KVI. Hey, Jerry, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Lars. Hey, I just had a point regarding the FBI investigation through the IG.
Yeah.
And what came to mind is, wasn't there a complicity with secret files under J. Edgar Hoover, and then they name a building after him, which became the FBI building?
Well, you are right that J. Edgar Hoover was the longtime director of the FBI, and yes, you are right that he kept secret files and a lot of dirt on, I think, everybody in Washington, D.C., and as the former director, yes, they did name a building after him. But when you say, was there complicity, I'm reasonably sure that J. Edgar Hoover, who had his own share of personal secrets, if you've read anything about the guy, he probably used all that private information himself to great political advantage. I'm sure it's great to have files full of secret data on people who are politicians, because then you can maintain your own position that way. But, you know, this is an agency that still has big trouble, I think. If Christopher Wray, the director, is out there today saying, oh, we found no evidence of any kind of political bias. I read through that report, and I don't think it's just because I'm a Trump voter. I think when I see that agents are saying, we will stop Donald Trump from becoming president, and this isn't, I said agent, but this is actually a high-ranking official within the FBI who was involved in the email investigation and then was put right in the middle of the Robert Mueller investigation. And we all know that Mueller hired a lot of Clinton loyalists who were attorneys. One of them even worked for the Clinton Foundation to investigate Donald Trump. Tell me the fix isn't in when the guy running the investigation is hiring lawyers who worked for the woman you beat in the election to investigate the current president of the United States. If that isn't political influence or political bias, I don't know what we'd call it. You get the last 10 seconds, Jerry.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. And that was the reason I brought up Hoover, because he kind of did the same thing, but he didn't have access to the internet and social media and everything else. So he did the old fashioned way, you know, had manila folders and wrote things down to get, like you were saying, leverage on political hacks.
That's right.